This summer, I joined a couple of friends of mine at Fruitlands, a farm 30 miles from here that once housed a short-lived utopian community and is now the site of a museum for relics of the past. What we saw there was a map of such communities in Massachusetts during the mid-19th century. The whole state was dotted with them, but somehow Massachusetts still had utopians to spare. We are a little wild here with numerous projects of social reform, Concord native Ralph Waldo Emerson wrote. Those who were among the wildest went west, out to Indiana, where a philanthropist hired intellectuals from the East Coast to come help him launch an experiment of communal living called, poetically enough, New Harmony. New Harmony sits on the Wabash River, and it was there these imported intellectuals arrived on what had, with much fanfare in the newspapers apparently, been dubbed the boatload of knowledge. Even their considerable stores of it could not make that social experiment a success, however, and like many such ventures of its era, the New Harmony community disbanded after a little while, leaving a town by that name. Author and Unitarian Universalist minister Nancy McDonald Ladd grew up near that place in what she characterized as the shadow of a dead utopia. In her book, After the Good News, Progressive Faith Beyond Optimism, Reverend Ladd notes that most of the utopias of this era did not last that long. And there were more than 100 of them nationwide at the time. Together, these proved two points simultaneously. First, that idealistic visions can be incredibly compelling. And second, that engineered societies are especially fragile. When people aspire to live in unspoiled communities, they learn very quickly how little it took to spoil them. Routine miscalculations and faulty projections, say, or stubborn human foibles and petty resentments. While some of these communities were secular, several were religious in their orientation, usually with a liberal bent. When we look back at them today, we may admire how forward-thinking they were for their time, serving as countercultural spaces where pioneering ideas around environmentalism, education, and gender equality could be affirmed. Some of these ideas would later become increasingly influential in American life. Even so, the rapid failures of these utopias served as material that authors and artists could easily convert to satire, and very often did. We ought to resist laughing too readily at it these days. Those of us in progressive religious communities are in many ways the spiritual heirs of these utopian forebears, for good and for bad. The members of our UU congregations generally tend to be better educated, well-resourced, if not outright affluent, and socially and politically liberal, although there are always exceptions. Ensconced in metropolitan areas, nice suburbs, and college towns, we too are tempted to believe that we can get right all the rest of the world gets wrong. At this critical distance from a privileged perspective, we can remain apart from the world instead of being a part of it and all its brokenness. So a certain exceptionalism persists in our ranks, and I say this as one who is as liable to it as anyone here. There's an old adage that holds that it is better to be lucky than good. In lucky moments, when we find a plump parking spot, say, or stay ahead of traffic, my husband and I are in the habit of quoting this to one another. It is better to be lucky than good, we take turns saying. We say this at those times when we know ourselves to be lucky. Often, though, people such as ourselves have a hard time differentiating between those states and simply consider themselves good when they have merely been lucky. With its optimistic worldview and high estimation of human nature, progressive religion reinforces the experiences of the fortunate far more than it resonates with the experiences of the misfortunate. The longer as I serve in our communities, the more clearly I see that. As Reverend Ladd writes, we can't borrow someone else's story. But the stories we tell about ourselves may be limiting in ways we cannot fully appreciate. Our congregations can become modern-day boatloads of knowledge, and within them we convince ourselves that if we could only find the correct angle of approach, then we could land on the shores and bring about the dawning of a brighter day. If not tomorrow, then a day or two after that. In essence, we consider that our mission. When we cast ourselves as powerful and perfectible, that eliminates any number of people who we might otherwise invite on board as our companions. It becomes especially confusing when those shores are perhaps more distant than any of us anticipated. We get tired and disheartened, and in consequence, increasingly impatient with one another. Underneath the will to mutuality, there is a will to perfection, a will to be personally justified, a will to be effective, and in the end, through all of our carefully calibrated strategies, a will to win the game that was never a game at all, wherever that contends. There is an idolatry of expectation that drives us in the liberal churches to imagine the dismantling of oppression was ever achievable through the limited mechanisms of our own personal efforts. Inevitably, our best personal efforts will prove inadequate. If we ourselves would like to become agents of social reform, Reverend Ladd suggests we must be willing to be transformed, not only individually, but collectively. We can become primed for this transformation through regular spiritual practice. Spiritual practice does not make perfect. Rather, it reminds us that none of us is perfect, and beyond that, that not a single one of us will ever be. The perfectionistic preoccupation that currently inhibits our congregational life seriously limits our potential for all sorts of growth. As Reverend Ladd reminds us, nothing we do will be perfect, so we need to manage our expectations accordingly. Liberal religious people not only tend to believe that we are called to perfection, but we also believe that we are already basically perfect, already basically converted, and already basically blessed, she notes. At times, we like to imagine these things without allowing for further conversions that might impinge on our freedom to be exactly as we already are, and to do exactly what we have been doing all along. We don't like to follow strategies that we ourselves have not set. Our resistance to following is frequently rooted in a misguided conviction that we really ought to be leading all the time. So sure are we of the enlightened ways that lead ahead. When we position ourselves as the advanced guard, the lessons of the past are soon lost on us. As we break from our benighted ancestors, we forget what they were called most immediately. As busy as we are correcting for their errors, we overlook the newer ones we ourselves are introducing. During the 20th century, our faith tradition extensively revised its liturgy, such that worship became nearly unrecognizable. Some doxologies remained in our hymnal, but gone were all the corporate rites of confession. Our services were billed as celebrations of life, as if our lives only presented us with occasions for celebration, as if we never once stepped into the sanctuary feeling hurt or insecure or terrified or betrayed or confused or heartsick, grief-stricken, or heaven forbid, ashamed of some poor choices that we ourselves had made, as if all our existence were already optimally engineered. And after the good news, Reverend Ladd makes a compelling argument that we need to reclaim our forfeit liturgies of lament and atonement. If we are too convinced of our essential goodness, we lose sight of how we could both do better and be better, of just how fallible we are prone to be almost continuously. That communal prayer we heard this morning combined elements of Ladd's public prayers of lament and atonement. But it's a very different thing to hear those lines as opposed to speaking them. Part of the reason we in the liberal church need to preach such humble litanies repeatedly is that our belief in the inherent goodness of human beings, our confidence in reason and self-culture and personal rectitude, has set us up, she concludes, not only for failure, but for fragility. Flawed people can be afraid, they can fail and try again. People of privilege aren't broken irreparably by that privilege, Reverend Ladd maintains. There's always another chance and a different story to tell about who we think we're meant to be in this beautiful and tragic world. Whatever we think our story is, we should probably stop sticking to it. Otherwise, we will stay stuck for far too long. How can desire fail, poet Denise Levertov asks us, when we have only begun to imagine justice and mercy? We have only begun to know the power that is in us if we could join our solitudes in the communion of struggle. There can be no joining in the universal struggle without sharing our own individual struggles with one another. Our congregational life gives us a context within which we can share those struggles openly and unabashedly. We should not deny the magnitude of them, but rather risk trusting in something far greater than ourselves, something that we might not even fully understand. Casual optimism rings hollow and triumphant. Self-assured liturgies leave our broken hearts still yearning for the chance to sing together in a minor key, Reverend Ladd observes, noting that people yearn for an honest word and an opportunity to hold our shared grief and deep personal brokenness together in community on a Sunday morning. In addition to our private disappointments, there may also be ideals we fear surrendering and compromises we ourselves may fear making. Those too can be named in our worship. We need not remain silent about our own uncertainty. Our mission is to plant ourselves at the gates of hope, not the prudent gates of optimism, which are somewhat narrower, the Reverend Victoria Safford proclaims. Once we find our way there, we can begin beckoning and calling, telling people what we are seeing, asking people what they see. We can allow for honest curiosity about both our circumstances and our prospects, which can feel rather worrisome these days. We can welcome people who are similarly curious. We don't need to surround ourselves only with those convinced of our ultimate human perfectibility and the progress of humankind onward and upward forever. Optimism tells a preordained narrative. It is an assertion that the scales have already been tipped toward triumph. Hope is different, Reverend Ladd explains. Like faith, hope is the exact opposite of certainty. It does not presume an outcome. These days, our religious progressive communities must offer people faith and hope alongside love and stop peddling simple reassurance. We have got to get out of the business of convincing everyone that a bright new day is dawning, if not tomorrow, then a day or two after that. The reality is that none of us have a clear path charted toward a better future. As ambitious or learned or accomplished or determined as we use may be, we are also capable of repeated and routine error. We can no longer consider our movement the boatload of knowledge. We have to recognize that we are more modestly on board the ship of not knowing, and so make continuous course corrections. Since none of us is infallible, we ought to at least stay humble. We can repent of our mistakes by reclaiming a religious language of lament and atonement that lets us do that in community. We have not always been good, though sometimes we have been very lucky. Whether we live near the Charles River or the Wabash River or further west in America along the Rio Grande, we have to admit that those olden days of utopia or bust are now gone. Utopias were always born of discontent with a larger culture, but today we need to be a part of the world, not apart from it, and recognize all the ways we ourselves are implicated in its shortcomings, however much discomfort that causes us. We cannot disband each time our idealized visions are not realized. We cannot leave ghost towns behind on every receding shoreline. At some point, we have to face ourselves, complete with our own imperfections and limitations and insecurities and, of course, blind spots. Reform really begins at home, and this is a spiritual challenge that calls for solid spiritual practice. The more fully we can inhabit our present reality, the keener our perception becomes. We may eventually hear a newer harmony sounding, one that includes ancient laments alongside our favorite futuristic anthems, the lowest tones blending with our highest notes. Let that become our song of progressive religion, one that very many more voices can join. Please rise in body and spirit for our final hymn this morning, number 344 in your gray hymnal, A Promise Through the Ages Rings, number 344.